Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Friday the 24th of July. Today, how Britain faces 8 years of painful spending cuts, no matter who wins the next election.
It does show how tight the public finances are and how severe the consequences of that will be.
Also today, a new hotline and website is launched by the government for people worried they've got swine flu.
There is a big question as to whether they are going to be able to spot other illnesses that might have similar symptoms.
And a copyright tussle over Europe's most popular folk song, a German beer hall yodel called Der Kufstein Lied. And we've got more of that music later in the show, as I'm sure you'll be delighted to hear. But first, the news and today's papers.
Britain will face spending cuts of more than 16% to key public services like law and order and higher education if Labour and the Tories deliver on their goals to protect schools, hospitals and defence, according to a warning from the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Labour and the Tories have both said they'd like to protect these four areas. The IFS says Britain's facing a decade of pain that will see the tightest constraint in public service spending since 1977. Motorists don't believe the government's claims that road taxes help cut carbon dioxide emissions and boost public transport investment, according to an MP's report released today. The report by the Commons Transport Committee suggests a voluntary pay-as-you-drive scheme. This would be used as a substitute for excise duty or fuel duty payments. According to an AA poll, 86% of UK drivers do not believe the government would deliver a fair road pricing programme. Votes are being counted in Norwich North after yesterday's by-election. It's the first election since the MP's expenses scandal, and the Tories believe their candidate, Chloe Smith, will win today. A by-election was triggered by the resignation of MP Ian Gibson. He quit after Labour ruled he would not be allowed to stand at the next election because he used parliamentary expenses to fund a flat which he subsequently sold at a discount to his daughter. A result is expected by lunchtime. Israel's invasion of Gaza this year prompted a huge increase in anti-Semitic attacks and intimidation in Britain, according to Jewish groups. The Community Security Trust recorded 609 anti-Semitic incidents in the first half of 2009, more than the total for all of last year. Much of the surge took place in January, when there were more than 9 incidents in the UK every day. And in sport, David Beckham insists he's staying with the LA Galaxy despite a hostile response from some fans to his return. The England midfielder was booed by sections of the crowd at his first home game after a loan spell at AC Milan. And Harry Redknapp's admitted he's on the lookout for a new central defender, as all three of his first-choice players sit on the injury bench. Ledley King, Jonathan Woodgate and Michael Dawson are all set to miss forthcoming friendlies against Barcelona and Celtic. Now for a look at today's papers, and The Guardian leads with an exclusive look at figures from the Institute for Fiscal Studies that predict serious spending cuts across several government departments. They quote the IFS's Deputy Director Carl Emerson warning Britain could be in for 8 years of pain. They also report pressure on the new swine flu website. The online diagnosis service crashed within minutes of launching. 3,000 people a second were trying to use it, more than double what had been expected. The Daily Mail also leads with swine flu. Its headline reports that cases have doubled to 100,000 in the last week. They also make room for new illegal drug figures linking the rise in cocaine use to the Labour government. The paper notes that since Tony Blair declared his war on drugs, there's been a 400% rise in the number of people taking cocaine. The Times focuses on public fear of the swine flu virus, quoting Peter Holden of the British Medical Association, saying there may be people telling porkies to get hold of antivirals. The Independent has a large picture of cocaine being cut with a razor under a headline, Cocaine Britain. Figures from the British Crime Survey suggest there's a huge increase in younger users, with the number of children treated for overdosing on Class A drugs tripling in a decade. The Mirror and The Sun both lead with stories about Michael Jackson. The Sun says his doctor made Jackson's son Prince watch attempts to resuscitate him, and the Mirror claims an exclusive with a story about his addiction to a sedative. For more on all those stories, keep up to date at guardian.co.uk.
Government borrowing is expected to account for 11.9% of GDP by next year. So the next government, Labour or Tory, will have to try and balance the books. A study for The Guardian by the Institute for Fiscal Studies today has found that Britain could face 8 years of painful spending cuts and tax increases. as Nicholas Watt, our chief political correspondent, reports.
Well, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, that we all obviously take very seriously now because it's their figures that they came up with a month and a half ago that led to the row between David Cameron and Gordon Brown that raged at Prime Minister's Questions for a month. Pretty important people. And what they've done is they've done some research that we're publishing in The Guardian today. And this is showing that if Labour and the Conservatives, who have hinted that they would like to protect spending, that means that spending would rise in line with inflation, for schools, for the NHS, for defence and for overseas aid, if they go ahead with that, then that will mean that other areas of departmental spending, well, in order to fund that, they would have to be cut over the next spending period, that's 3 years, 2011 to 2014, they'd have to be cut by 16.3%, which is pretty hefty. And what that really does is that demonstrates really the challenge of what Britain will be facing with public spending cuts in the next spending round. I think most people think that those IFS figures, when it actually comes to it, you're not going to be seeing cuts at that level, not least because no party really at the moment is talking about serious tax rises, because guess what, we're facing an election in just under a year's time. The thinking in Whitehall is that there will have to be pretty serious tax rises, maybe put VAT up to 20p. And if you do that, then obviously you won't have to have such severe spending cuts. But nevertheless, it does show how tight the public finances are and how severe the consequences of that will be.
Nick, you've also been speaking to some former chancellors. What's their view of the prospects for public finances over the next few years?
Well, it's interesting that the four chancellors that I've spoken to, that's Dennis Healy, Geoffrey Howe, Nigel Lawson and Norman Lamont, are all different people. Obviously, three of them Conservatives, one Dennis Healy Labour. They all had a different approach to the world, but they're all agreed on one thing, which is that the public finances are in a very difficult position and that there will have to be very serious public spending cuts during the next spending period. That's after the general election.
And you've also heard from some senior civil servants. I mean, what have they said about the way that Whitehall copes with spending cuts?
Well, that's right. My colleagues, Allegra Stratton and Patrick Winter, have been speaking to retired senior mandarins. These are the people who have been running Whitehall and, interestingly, have now set up this organisation called the Institute for Government, which is a non-party body, and it is advising all the main parties, also advising the Conservatives as they prepare for government. And what some of these senior retired mandarins are saying is that really the way that Whitehall is organised really entrenches inefficiency. And one of the big criticisms that they make is what they call duplication, which is that the way that spending is allocated at the moment is for individual departments, because what happens is party wins the general election, all the new ministers say they're going to work together, then they're made secretaries of state, they get their individual baronies within a few months, they jealously guard that, jealously push for their budget, they get individual budgets, whereas what you should be talking about, according to these retired civil servants, is not focusing money on individual departments like health, like schools, like the Home Office. What you should be doing is you should be taking the big issues like climate change, like obesity, like child welfare, and you should be directing spending in that direction rather than giving it to the individual barons.
Nicholas Watt in our Westminster office, and there's full coverage today at guardian.co.uk/politics. Also on The Guardian's website today, the new single by Muse features a section of Chopin's Ninth Symphony. Stuart Jeffries provides a guide to classical music for younger listeners, and we'll also look at how classical music has been used in other recent pop songs at guardian.co.uk/music. Giles Tremlett speaks to Brits on the Costa del Sol. For many, the economic downturn has shattered their lives there. guardian.co.uk/Spain. And How to Pack by Jess Cartner-Morley. Essential reading, guardian.co.uk/travel. 100,000 people in England have sought help over swine flu over the past week, according to the Department of Health. And the number of people consulting their GP because of swine flu has almost doubled in the last 7 days. And there are 840 people in hospital with the virus. Well, against that level of concern, the government launched its National Flu Pandemic Service yesterday. With the details is The Guardian's David Batty.
Well, it's meant to be a one-stop shop for all the information you require on swine flu and the flu pandemic, and if you want information about symptoms. And you should, on the hotline, get through to somebody who can give you an assessment of that. And there's a questionnaire on the website that does the same thing.
Well, let's talk about the hotline first of all. How did that go?
Well, I did get through on the hotline when I rang yesterday, obviously not wanting to take up their time. I just switched off immediately. I got through to a person. That was simple enough. There wasn't a long wait. They just go through these questions, asking your symptoms and, you know, any sort of serious medical history you might have. But the website was a different story.
Well, tell us about that.
Well, the website was meant to go live at 3 o'clock, and it did a couple of minutes after that. But by 3:04, it crashed, really, and it put up a line that just said, "The service is currently very busy and cannot deal with your request at this time." And an hour after that, it was still putting out the same message.
How is it supposed to work?
Well, you're meant to be able to go through to this questionnaire so you can sort of self-assess yourself, which then I presume is then goes through at some kind of human being who then authorises whether or not you will get the drugs.
The health service has put this service together pretty quickly, haven't they?
Well, that's debatable, because there's been a lot of complaints from some doctors and obviously the opposition parties that this service should have been up and running when the World Health Organization actually declared the flu pandemic a couple of months ago. One would say, on balance, possibly not. But having said that, it's a very major IT operation, so you want to get it right. And unfortunately, as of, you know, when I tested it yesterday, it didn't seem they had quite got it right yet.
How will they decide who gets Tamiflu? Because I mean, presumably this is open to abuse, this hotline and website.
Well, this is the big worry there is, and the chief medical officer, Professor Sir Liam Donaldson, has said in previous press conferences that I've been to that they're just going to rely on the honesty of the public.
Oh dear.
Whether or not that's a very good thing to rely on amid sort of headlines about sort of swine flu apocalypse is another matter, because I suspect that there will be a lot of people who will just want to get the drugs and have them in the house.
And isn't there also a danger that swine flu symptoms might mask more serious illnesses like meningitis?
Yeah, I mean, and that is the other concern, because, for example, on the actual hotline, the telephone hotline is not manned by medically trained staff. So there is a big question as to whether they are going to be able to spot other illnesses that might have similar symptoms, or people who might have an underlying health condition that could mean that a swine flu infection would be far more dangerous for them.
This hotline only covers England. What happens if you feel that you might have swine flu and you live outside England?
Well, you just have to contact your GP.
Okay, got that, folks? David, many thanks.
Thank you.
David Batty, and the telephone helpline, which is available for anyone in England, is at 0800 15 13 100. And the website is pandemicflu.direct.gov.uk.
Guardian Daily, news and reports from around the world.
My name's John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Daily, how surfers are helping the National Trust look after Britain's coastline.
I use the National Trust land every day. I go surfing on the beaches and I park in the car parks, so it makes sense to protect what I use.
But first, over 500,000 people between the ages of 16 and 24 have taken cocaine and ecstasy in the last year. That's according to new Home Office statistics. Alan Travis is our Home Affairs editor.
Well, the annual drugs misuse declared figures from the British Crime Survey, which just covers England and Wales and is a kind of self-report survey, what it shows is that cocaine use in England and Wales has gone up rather surprisingly to about 3% of all adults. That's about nearly 1 million people who say they used cocaine last year. And more of the worryingly, that includes about 400,000 young people aged between 16 and 24.
Why is that?
Cocaine has gone through a period of plunging street prices and not surprisingly, therefore, greater wider availability, and is now no longer kind of seen as the middle class dinner table drug.
And there's also more evidence of a long-term decline in the use of cannabis.
Yes, cannabis use, which kind of peaked in the mid-1990s, particularly young people. I think about 1996, about 28% of young people on this survey said that they had used cannabis in the last 12 months. That's more than a quarter of the school population. It's come down to about 18% now. And although the figures went up slightly this year, that long-term trend of decline has continued, and this is despite the government's decision to reclassify cannabis from down from B to C, having put up from C to B and then back down to from B to C. Although the penalties have changed, it doesn't seem to have had any impact on that decline in popularity.
Are people simply switching from cannabis to cocaine and other Class A drugs?
No, I mean, cannabis, I think, is by far the most popular illicit drug use in the country. I think about for adults, about 84% of those who use any kind of illicit drug use cannabis alone. But there is some poly drug use going on, which is worrying to people. What's the new feature, perhaps, is an increase in popularity of a drug called ketamine, which is an anesthetic and sometimes used as a horse tranquilizer, which has become particularly popular in the last, since it was banned 3 years ago, unfortunately, and about 125,000 young people seem to have tried that drug in the last year.
What kind of person is more likely to take drugs?
Well, the British Crime Survey comes out with what we call a typical illicit drug user, and it does explode some stereotypes. They're much more likely to be white than black or any other ethnic minority group. Young, single, male, probably quite poor, possibly unemployed, possibly on an income of less than £10,000 a year. Interestingly, they say that the single strongest predictor of whether someone is likely to be an illicit drug user or not is marital status. So perhaps marriage might be the best antidote for those who think they've got who are single males with an out-of-control recreational drug habit.
Alan Travis. Now this, believe it or not, is thought to be Europe's most popular folk song. That's Der Kufstein Lied, performed here by Franzl Lang. But it's considered a yodeling classic, sung by lederhosen-clad Germans in beer halls the world over. The German-speaking world over, anyway. As Kate Connolly reports from Berlin, royalties from the song have been the subject of a fiercely contested court battle this week.
Well, basically, there's a song which is called the Kufstein Lied, which is well known to all of the fans of German folk music around the world. There are many of them, believe you me. The refrain of this song, which is a very famous Hollera, Diri, 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 is basically a man of music publisher has claimed that he wrote the refrain, jazzing up the original version that an Austrian composer, Karl Ganzer, wrote 63 years ago. And he says that it was the refrain that he wrote that turned it into the hit that it became. The court case has centred on a row between the heirs of the original composer Karl Ganzer, his son and daughter, and the music publisher Egon Frauenberger, who says he rewrote the refrain. And Frauenberger wanted to have a 12th of the royalties, which he said would reflect the input he had in this song, and the heirs of Karl Ganzer said that this was rubbish, that they should get all the royalties.
And the composer's family have won the dispute.
The composer's family have won the dispute. This was a court case. It was being heard in a Munich courtroom, quite an unusual battle that was going on this week. They basically have successfully sued Frauenberger, and therefore he now no longer has any rights to any of the royalties.
Why does this song have such a central place in German and Bavarian culture?
Well, I'm no yodeling expert, but basically it is a yodel, which is a tradition that goes back centuries and basically was used by men in the Alps who used to sing to each other between the mountain peaks. So it was a very effective way of communicating. And this is a very sort of, if you like, a jazzy yodel number. It celebrates a town in Austria called Kufstein, is, if you go to the Oktoberfest in Munich, or if you watch the music, German folk music programmes, which take up a large part of German TV coverage in the evenings, you'll hear this a lot. And it really, you know, you see even the hardiest of lederhosen-clad Germans go weak at the knees whenever anybody starts singing the Kufstein lead.
I won't ask you to yodel, Kate.
Thank you.
Kate Connolly. Surfing has become one of the UK's most popular participation sports, and the National Trust has enlisted surfers' help in looking after the UK's coastline, as Stephen Morris found out when he went to Godrevy in North Cornwall to meet the National Trust's Robin Davis, herself five times Britain's women's champion surfer.
I must admit, I'm probably wrong in this, but I still think of the National Trust as stately homes and gardens and tea rooms. But here we are on a surfing beach, and you're doing work for the National Trust here.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think in the past, the National Trust definitely has been perceived as beautiful gardens and ancient houses. But the Trust is actually so much more than that, and it looks after about 35% of the Devon and Cornwall coastline. And parts of that coastline host some of Britain's best surfing waves. And so to connect with the surfing community kind of made sense, because the surfers use the coastline year round. It's not just a summer sport, especially in winter when we get our best swells. And so these are people who are out on the coastline every day, all year, enjoying beautiful, rugged National Trust properties.
So what did your job entail?
Crikey, it's really diverse actually, and a very fun job, from working with schools and school groups doing eco surf lessons with the local wardens, who've got a massively in-depth skill and knowledge of the local areas, from sand dune management through to grazing techniques and that kind of thing, to putting together a National Trust surf ambassador team.
We're going to meet somebody later, I think.
Yeah, we are. Alan Stokes, one of the ambassadors, is going to come down and chat to us. If you want, Steve, you can go for a surf with him.
I don't know about that. He's Britain's number one, isn't he?
He is, yeah. He's an extremely talented surfer, as are all the ambassadors in their own right. And to have them on board is just a real honour for the Trust.
Alan Stokes, and I'm a surf ambassador for the National Trust.
Sounds a good title. You're also Britain's number one surfer,
we should remember. Yeah, I'm currently ranked number one on the UK tour.
So why are you an ambassador for the National Trust?
It just seems fitting, really. I mean, I use the National Trust land every day. I go surfing on the beaches and I park in the car park. So, it makes sense to protect what I use. And Cornwall's quite special. The coastlines are beautiful. So I think we have such an influx of tourists that come here every year. We need to protect it and make sure it's treated right.
This is probably completely unfair. As a non-surfer, you kind of think of surfers as coming, jumping out in the waves, having a barbecue, going home, partying all the time. But clearly there's a social responsibility there as well.
Yeah, no, you pretty much hit the nail on the head. But we've got to take care of what we love. And that's it, really. It's as simple as it is.
Why is Cornwall so special to you?
I don't know. It's just nowhere else like it in Britain. Yeah, I love it.
Are you surfing today? Do you surf every day?
Surf every day if there's waves, yeah.
Depends on the weather and the waves and so on?
Yeah, it depends on the size of the waves, the winds, the tides. Yeah, loads of different things.
You go surfing after this?
I might do, yeah. The wind's gone really weird, but yeah, I'll have a look.
Once it goes to the seaside,
Francesca Panetta and Harriet Grant produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.